Greetings, dear Dhamma friends, this is Ajahn Acalo. I am very pleased to be able to share with you on this occasion this Dhamma sharing and reflection commentary on the Anattalakkhana Sutta that was given while on retreat in Malaysia. I just wanted to mention that every now and then there's a slight bit of feedback noise which is occurring because the Bluetooth mic was interfering with the lapel condenser mic. And basically, when you teach on the road like this, even with good equipment, sometimes stuff like this happens. It's samsara. It only gets so good. I'm sure you understand. So please do persevere. It's literally just a few seconds every now and then. I believe the content is worth listening to, and I hope that you find something in the sharing of benefit to you. I hope your understanding and your practice. Be well. Today's talk is going to be primarily about the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the Discourse on Not-Self, which we have been chanting together in evenings, on a couple of evenings. Now we can contemplate the meaning of those words. It is a teaching which is peculiar to Buddhism, and very important teaching. At the same time, it's not just a matter of understanding the teaching and the concept, it's how we investigate it, how we apply it, with what attitude. So that's a bit tricky, but in thinking in terms of other religions, in Hinduism, Brahmanism, you have this idea of becoming one with God, Atman. So it's not that you abandon yourself, it's your self-view, your attachment to a self-view. It's that you, through love and devotion, one-pointed love and devotion to a God, you become one with that God. And that seems to be the general approach in what they call theistic religions, Christianity, Hinduism. So Lord Buddha's teaching was revolutionary and uncommon in his day, and it's a little bit difficult to understand in as much as it requires nuance. So it's not that in understanding the concept of not-self you no longer have the self-view. This is the part that's tricky, and some people get confused because they understand. We'll go through the sutta and it's easy enough to understand. It's easy enough to investigate what Lord Buddha is asking us to investigate. And yet the feeling of self persists. And so what is it? It's good to give some thought to what the self-view is, and then how to go about letting go of one's attachment to it. So Lord Buddha does say some heroic lion's roar like words about it. In one of the weeks after his enlightenment, Lord Buddha was enjoying the bliss of liberation. At the end of 7 days, after emerging from that concentration, the Blessed One surveyed the world with the eye of an enlightened one. As he did so, he saw many beings burning with the many fires and consumed with the many fevers born of lust, of hate, and of delusion. Knowing the meaning of this, he then uttered this exclamation: "This world is anguished, being exposed to contact. Even what the world calls self is in fact ill. For no matter upon what it conceives, the fact is ever other than that. The world whose being is to become other is committed to being, is exposed to being, relishes only being. Yet what it relishes brings fear, and what it fears is pain. Now this holy life is lived to abandon suffering." So, Lord Buddha, saying what the world calls self is ill, it's an illness. Because of it, because of our attachment to it, we are exposed to contact. What kind of contact? Sense contact. We have a body and a mind. You think it's a self, then you're grasping at it, and then you have sense contact. Sense contact or is always either pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant. Even the pleasant constantly changes. We're always separated from the pleasant. So sometimes Lord Buddha explains the pleasant as also suffering, because it contains within it the fact that when we get separated from it, we will grieve it, we will miss it. So then another, after another week under the Bodhi tree, contemplating what he had attained and enjoying the bliss of his liberation, he uttered another verse. Seclusion is happiness for one contented, by whom the Dhamma is learnt and who has seen. Friendliness towards the world is happiness for him who is forbearing with living beings. Disinterest in the world is happiness for him that has surmounted sense desires. But to be rid of the conceit, I am, is the greatest happiness of all. So, 8 lines, but with profound meaning, which you'd expect. Lord Buddha's just become enlightened, and he's been meditating for a week under the Bodhi tree, and he is having his profound experiences and realizations. So. But in this paragraph, there are some interesting suggestions about attitude. Seclusion is happiness for one who is contented. So contentment is an attitude. And Ajahn Chah once said in Thai, Kwam ruay yuti po jai, wealth depends on contentment. If you are content with it, you are wealthy. He also said on another occasion that he's never met a truly wealthy person. People were confused because by the time he was famous, he did know wealthy people. But what he said was, I only ever meet people who still think they don't have enough. That's what he meant by it. I've never met a wealthy person. I've only met people who want more. Friendliness towards the world is happiness for him who is forbearing with living beings. So, with regard to our attitude, in the way that we contemplate not self, there are suggestions here about contentment. There are suggestions here about being forbearing and friendly. So this is where we have to understand that the attitude of loving kindness and the practice of loving kindness, which starts with feelings of kindness towards one's conventional self and others' selves, that's the foundation upon which we contemplate not self. So if you understand that the self view is a very powerful thing, remember Lord Buddha considered not teaching it because he thought that people aren't going to get this. Beings are so committed to perceiving things in terms of self and other. It's like if we were fish, it's the water that we swim in. We can't see it. We perceive everything in terms of self, so it's very difficult to see and experience not self. It can be done with training, and that's what Lord Buddha teaches. But how do you do it? So if you try to destroy the self-view. I once knew a young man when I was a young man, 19, and we had done some meditation retreats. And he decided that he was going to practice not self. He wasn't going to be a self. Self isn't real, it's a delusion, so he was going to practice not self. So he actually went crazy. And so that's the kind of thing that can happen if you do this with a wrong understanding, wrong attitude. You can't destroy it. It's like, okay, so let's just accept that it's an illness that we have. It's an illness that we have, so how do we live with the illness while we treat it? I think that's and at the same time you don't hate it and you don't resent it. So when we acknowledge that it's an illness, we don't have contempt for it. So we try to have compassion. Just as if a friend had cancer, you wouldn't hate the cancer. You'd have compassion for the person with the cancer. So I think this is a good attitude. We have this illness. We have the conceit of I and mine. And we're very attached to it. So you have to steward the healthy functioning of the self to the degree that you can. And a healthy self is a self which knows contentment, which knows how to be humble, generous and kind, forgiving, patient self. So in a way, I was talking this morning about how Lord Buddha sometimes describes his teachings as leading to heaven and beyond, and how I once asked Ajahn Anand if devas could realize Dhamma, and he said, only devas realize Dhamma, meaning that the level of the mind of a person who has an insight is on the level of a deva, meaning there is metta, there is conscience, there is a respect for what they call conscience and shame, like fear of wrongdoing. Those kind of qualities are in the mind of a person who realizes Dhamma. Goodness, basically. Goodness is established virtue. From that foundation, people have insights into not-self. So this is where the metta practices are, and all of the Brahmavihara practices, metta, compassion, mudita, appreciative joy, equanimity. So these are ways that you can have a healthy, humble self-view, which is the foundation for contemplating not-self. So don't try to destroy it, don't hate it, don't have contempt for it. At the same time, we should be kind of fed up with the experience. So it is tricky, there's a lot of nuance here. We should be weary, kind of world-weary. We should be fed up with being pushed around by greed, hatred and delusion. But you don't aim your resentment at the self-view. You have to channel it into skillful effort. That's what works. That's what will help people to eradicate it or have insights into it, into not-self, and slowly weaken that delusion. And we can also notice that if you visit an enlightened master, it's good to see that they still have a personality. So it's not like when they become an arahant, they're like this pristine white glacier, you know, cold, empty. I destroyed it all. I got rid of my conceit. Now you should do that too. They're often very humorous. I've seen my teacher literally slap his thigh laughing when something funny happened. So conventionally there still is funny things. And they have quite distinct personalities. The thing is, they know it's not the truth. That's not where their liberation isn't in the personality. The liberation is their realization of the unconditioned that knows conditions as conditions without being confused by them. But even Lord Buddha, most of the suttas or many suttas start with, when the courteous and amiable speech was over, Lord Buddha addressed such and such. So basically he would have a chat with people. How are you doing? How are the crops? How's the kingdom? And then teach them, and oftentimes people became realized. So we're not going to try to destroy it. We're not going to hate it. We're not going to have contempt for it. At the same time, we're not going to indulge it. So this is tricky. Middle way. How to steward a healthy functioning of the self while slowly humbling it and uprooting its attachment and its vanity and its conceit. It takes time. It can be done. Keeping the precepts, being generous. Generosity is a good, very powerful method because we can become identified with our wealth. And so if you give yourself some, give away what you can, practicing giving happiness to others, it's not so special. Because you're wealthy, if you help others to be special. Okay, you be special, you be special, let's all be special. It's not just going to be me who's special. And it's very effective if we empower others and train ourselves to have a happiness that comes from seeing others as happy, the mudita practice. So if people have that tendency of being happy when they have personal victories, but that's very dangerous because the self can get bigger and bigger. So it's good to have personal victories in areas that are important, but it's also good to enable and empower others at the same time if you can, and to not feed vanity and conceit. So I'm going to talk now a little bit about the benefits of metta practice, and then we'll look at the sutra not self. And then people have asked me, if we're practicing not self, what is this, may I be well, may I be happy, Ajahn? May all beings be well, may all beings be happy. And I said, well, that's where you have to start. So one of the benefits of loving kindness, I'll read them all. I'll just mention where it is. It is the Anguttara Nikaya, the discourse on the advantages of loving kindness. And thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living near Savatthi at Jetavana at Anathapindika's monastery. Then he addressed the monks, saying, "Venerable monks," and they answered, "Venerable sir." The Blessed One then spoke as follows, "Monks, 11 advantages are to be expected from the release of heart by familiarizing oneself with thoughts of loving kindness, by the cultivation of loving kindness, by constantly increasing these thoughts, by regarding loving kindness as a vehicle and also as something to be treasured, by living in conformity with these thoughts, by putting these ideas into practice and by establishing them." What are the 11? One sleeps in comfort. One wakes in comfort. One has no evil dreams. One becomes dear to human beings. One becomes dear to non-human beings. Devas protect one. 7. Fire, poison and sword cannot touch one. 8. The mind concentrates quickly. Very interesting. 9. One's countenance is serene. 10. One dies without being confused in mind. 11. If one fails to attain arhantship here and now, one will be reborn in a Brahma world. So this is if one takes the metta bhavana to the jhana level. These 11 advantages, monks, are to be expected from the release of heart by familiarizing oneself with thoughts of loving kindness, by cultivation of loving kindness, by constantly increasing these thoughts, by regarding loving kindness as a vehicle, and also as something to be treasured, by living in conformity with these thoughts, by putting these ideas into practice and by establishing them. So said the Blessed One. Those monks rejoiced at the words of the Blessed One. So quite a short sutta, but important sutta. Last year there was a Sri Lankan monk staying at my monastery, Anandagiri, and he was bitten by a snake. He stood on the snake in the night time. And he's a very good monk. He'd be inspired with what he did. He went in and cleaned up his kuti so that if he died, he wouldn't be leaving a mess. And I wasn't there, I was in India. I got an email 2 days later, "Oh, by the way, so-and-so got bitten by a snake." So he had no symptoms. So what happened is the snake bit him, but the snake did not inject the venom. And he specifically told me that he had been cultivating a lot of metta while he was in that part of the forest. And so fire, poison and sword cannot touch him. That's benefit number 7. So I do think these things are real. There was another time, a friend and I were in Ladakh in northern India. This is about 12 years ago. And there was some serious flooding and some landslides and a lot of people died. They were buried alive in large amounts of mud. So we were in Ladakh and we were in a very remote, by a Himalayan lake, about 5,000 meters elevation. And I'd really wanted to go and meditate next to a Himalayan lake. What would that be like? And we didn't even know that it doesn't rain in Ladakh. Apparently it only snows in Ladakh. But coming from Southeast Asia, heavy rain is, okay, it's raining again. But it doesn't rain in Ladakh. It snows in Ladakh and then the snow slowly melts as the weather warms up. So we did see the storm clouds, but we didn't know it was a problem. But we both had a feeling, although a car had been hired and we had come to see some kind of Tibetan nomads having their archery contest riding horses, so that's a little bit exciting, isn't it? You know, the kind of thing you might only see once in a life. And that was happening the next day, and I just had this really like my mind was itching with irritation, and the thought just kept coming to me, "You have to go, you have to go, you have to go." And so I said to him, I didn't want to disappoint him because we'd come all that way and we'd hired the car and we'd got over the altitude sickness, the headaches, and we were there and the archery show was tomorrow. And I said to him, "Francois, my French friend, I just got a really strong feeling that we should leave." And he said, "Me too, I have a feeling too. I didn't want to say anything." "Oh, okay, so we're leaving tomorrow. But we prepaid our rent, we prepaid our food, no problem, let's get out of here." So we said our goodbyes and I had a friend there who was doing some eye treatment for nomads because they're so high, many people get cataracts, and she was giving away Polaroid sunglasses and treating eyes, etc. So the friend was a bit miffed. Why are you leaving? It's the big show tomorrow. We just have to go. And so anyway, we did leave. 2 hours after we left, the road was closed by a very big mudslide. And so what was that benefit? Devas protect one who cultivates loving kindness. So we both feel that feeling, get out of here, get out of here, get out of here. Where's that coming from? It's probably coming from an unseen being that knows what's about to happen. So there was a group of Australians, I think it was about 40 people, and they had to walk up these Himalayan mountains and down these valleys until they found another road. And bridges got washed out too. So we were driving along this road. It had rained heavily the night before, but we didn't know, like I said, rain, so what? But the thing about the Himalayas is they're not like rock mountains. It's two continents that have crashed together, and it's basically dust and stones piled very, very, very high. And so if it rains on them, there's a lot of mud instantly. So they, you know, without their own sleeping bags and quite exposed, they had a really horrific experience of climbing out of the Himalayan valley. So I do believe that there are benefits to cultivating loving kindness practice. Prevent disasters, have a long opportunity to keep practicing. So we'll have a look at the Sutra Not Self. You recall Lord Buddha had realized his liberation, then he had considered who he would teach. He thought of his first two teachers, the teachers that taught him 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th jhana, but he saw that they had already passed away and been reborn in a Brahma world. He couldn't teach them. So then he thought of the 5 other monks who he had practiced austerities with, and he saw that they did have spiritual powers, spiritual faculties that were developed enough that they would realize the Dhamma. So he wandered in stages and he taught the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, 4 Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, and Anya Kondanya had the insight. All that has the nature to arise has the nature to cease and attain to the first level of enlightenment, which is referred to as stream entry, entering a stream of Nibbana, where it's not possible to have more than 7 more lives and not possible to fall to a lower realm, lower than human realm. In a subsequent day, Lord Buddha taught this discourse on the characteristic of not-self. Thus have I heard. At one time the Blessed One was dwelling in Benares in the deer park. There he addressed the group of 5 bhikkhus. Form, bhikkhus, is not-self. If bhikkhus, form were self, then form would not lead to affliction, and one might be able to say in regard to form, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. But since bhikkhus, form is not self, form therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to form, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. So it's true. Can any of you wish that you were younger, and will it happen? My dear aging auntie friends. Don't worry, I'm an aging uncle. We don't have much control over it, do we? If you get sick, can you just wish that the illness goes away? Arthritis, various things. I can't wish the hair back onto my head. It's okay, I let go. Feeling is not self. If because feeling were self, feeling would not lead to affliction. And one might be able to say in regard to feeling, let my feeling be thus, let my feeling not be thus. But since bhikkhus, feeling is not self, feeling therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to feeling, let my feeling be thus, let my feeling not be thus. So, have any of you, when you had shoulder pain, back pain, knee pain, simply had the thought, go away, and did it go away? Interesting. Perception is not self. If bhikkhus, perception were self, perception would not lead to affliction. And one might be able to say in regard to perception, let my perception be thus, let my perception not be thus. But since bhikkhu's perception is not self, perception therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to perception, let my perception be thus, let my perception not be thus. So the way we perceive things, often conditioned by past memories, past experiences, and very deep impressions. So, I don't know if you've had that experience, but sometimes, we want to be kind, we want to be good people, and sometimes you meet somebody and you just don't like them, and they haven't done anything wrong, and you really wish you could like them, but you don't. Has anyone else had that experience? Yeah, so this is, what is that? Probably it's possible that you had some conflict in past relationships and there's some kind of intuitive awareness, oh, him again. But we wouldn't choose to have that perception, we wouldn't choose not to like people. We would ideally have impartial loving kindness for everybody. So obviously a forgiveness practice plays an important role in not developing more of these grudges in samsara, but we just can't. Also, you can give yourself a really hard time because you just perceive yourself as not good enough. And if you could have the really big picture, it might be the case that you're doing fine. You don't know how much you've improved. You don't know how bad you used to be. We can't see exactly where we are because we don't have the big picture. But have you had the experience where you're just giving yourself a really hard time and you're trying hard enough, you're trying to be sincere, but there's this part of you that just is sneering at yourself saying, not good enough. And having that experience doesn't usually help. But sometimes we can't stop it, it's very painful. So even the way we perceive ourselves can be very painful. We don't have mastery of it yet. Mental formations are not self. If bhikkhus, mental formations were self, mental formations would not lead to affliction. And one might be able to say in regard to mental formations, let my mental formations be thus, let my mental formations not be thus. But since bhikkhus, mental formations are not self, mental formations therefore lead to affliction. And one is not able to say in regard to mental formations, let my mental formations be thus, let my mental formations not be thus. So if you could, you would only have kind thoughts, thoughts of loving kindness, compassionate thoughts, wise thoughts. How often do you come to meditate, your mind's fairly peaceful, you're intending to have a peaceful meditation, and after 5 minutes there's an unwholesome fantasy happening? I'm sure, has anybody had that experience in the last week? Yes. So we have to train them, but we do not yet have mastery of them. Consciousness is not self. If bhikkhus, consciousness were self, consciousness would not lead to affliction, and one might be able to say in regard to consciousness, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness not be thus. But since bhikkhus, consciousness is not self, consciousness therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to consciousness, let my consciousness be thus, let my consciousness not be thus. So as a young monk, I remember a small thing could trigger a depression, and depression could last 3 or 4 days. And it was very frustrating because the thing that was happening wouldn't seem to justify becoming so dejected. And I would assume that this is karma, so some karma that had to be worked through. But you want to have energy for practice, you want to be diligent, you want to put forth a lot of effort, and a depressed mind is a difficult thing to work with. So that's a kind of a consciousness, isn't it? Mind becomes depressed. Then similarly, if you can absorb into a jhana, that's a kind of consciousness, the mind that is absorbed in bright radiant states. Eventually you probably will be able to absorb into various absorptions at will, but at the moment we can't do it. So, not self. What do you think about this, bhikkhus? Is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change? As this is mine, I am this, this is myself, it is not Lord. What do you think about this, bhikkhus? Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change? As this is mine, I am this is myself, it is not Lord. What do you think about this, bhikkhus? Is perception permanent or impermanent? impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this, this is myself, it is not, Lord. What do you think about this, bhikkhus? Are mental formations permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent, painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this, this is myself, it is not, Lord. What do you think about this, bhikkhus? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. But is that which is impermanent, painful or pleasurable? Painful, Lord. But is it fit to consider that which is impermanent, painful, of a nature to change, as this is mine, I am this, this is myself? It is not, Lord. So here Lord Buddha has masterfully, like the physician that he is, treating the illness. The habit is that we grasp at all of it as a self. But when you look at it as the separate phenomena, it can be investigated. You can't find the self there. But when the mind deludedly grasps as it as a conglomerate of these things functioning together, we think it's a self. But when he asked these bhikkhus, they replied, there's no self in any of these things, Lord. So now he instructs them about the attitude with which they should look upon these things. Wherefore, bhikkhus, whatever form there is, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, whether it is far or near, all form should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it really is thus. This is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Whatever feeling there is, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, whether it is far or near, all feeling should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it really is, thus. This is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Whatever perception there is, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, etc. This is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Whatever mental formations there are, past, present, future, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, etc. This is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Whatever consciousness there is, past, future, present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, whether far or near, all consciousness should, by means of right wisdom, be seen as it really is thus, this is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Seeing in this way, bhikkhus, the wise, noble disciple becomes disenchanted with form, becomes disenchanted with feeling, becomes disenchanted with perception, becomes disenchanted with mental formations, becomes disenchanted with consciousness. Becoming disenchanted, their passions fade away. With the fading of passion, the heart is liberated. With liberation there comes the knowledge, it is liberated, and they know. Destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived out, done is what had to be done, there is no more coming into any state of being. Thus spoke the Blessed One. Delighted, the group of five bhikkhus rejoiced in what the Lord had said. Moreover, while the discourse was being delivered, the minds of the five bhikkhus were freed from the defilements through clinging no more. And there were five more arahants in the world. So this last paragraph, second last paragraph, is very important. Seeing in this way, bhikkhus, the wise noble disciple becomes disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling, perception, mental formations and consciousness. So disenchanted, you can think of other words, not fascinated, no longer fascinated with, no longer deluded by, seeing them as they are, in being disenchanted. Becoming disenchanted, the passions fade away. So if you're thinking it's a self, and if you're trying to get maximum pleasant feeling out of the sense bases, then that's the opposite of being disenchanted. So worldly beings wanting peak experience, wanting pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, pleasant taste, pleasant touch, that's the opposite of disenchantment. seeing that all feelings change, pleasant feelings become painful feelings, we have to be separated from pleasure, etc., then one loses the commitment, the deluded obsession with trying to have only pleasant experiences, because you can't. And even the pleasant will change and become suffering. So this is this attitude of contentment and delighting in seclusion. Disenchantment starves the passions. So with the fading of passion, the heart is liberated. What is passion? Greed and hatred, three types of cravings. Craving for, craving not for, craving for being. So with the fading of passion, the heart is liberated. So this is our precepts. Keep the passions within a safe container, and they get weaker over time. And you keep up your practice, spiritual powers get more powerful, and you're able to have more and more mental pleasure. And when you have the peace from that comes from a good mindfulness, good concentration, good wisdom, you're not interested in the inferior pleasant feelings that come from the sense bases. You are more interested in the more pure, more refined pleasure that comes from mental cultivation. But it's a process. But very important to hear this message, because our assumptions are very deep and very strong. Most people wouldn't think that the path to liberation is one of disenchantment and dispassion. You would think, be generous, be kind, be nice, have faith. There's a kind of a commitment to trying to be happier. Buddhists want to be nice, good, happy people. And examples like the Dalai Lama, he is very happy. He invested a couple of million lives into that. For a lot of people, happiness is... I personally don't like the idea of striving for happiness, because it's very difficult to have an unchanging happy state. I prefer encouraging people to aspire to be peaceful and to have well-being, because with the kind of karmas that we have, that's an achievable goal. But it's an important thing to understand that if you do feel weary and dispassionate, don't think something's going wrong. This is probably a sign of growth, and something that personally I prefer to teach 8, 9, 10 day retreats than one-off talks to lay people, because I often feel like I can't tell people what the teachings really are as far as I understand them. Because people want to be affirmed, and people want empathy for their suffering, and basically it's a serious practice, and encourage people to become dispassionate and disenchanted. That's not what they're coming to the Dhamma talk to hear, is it? The thing is, dispassionate towards worldly things, disenchanted with worldly things. What's occurring in the mind is the mind is becoming more and more peaceful, more and more rapturous, more and more content. So that the process is, the more you can see that this stuff isn't worth grasping at, isn't worth identifying with, you do get fed up with it. There is a sense of, sense contact, sense bases, feelings constantly changing, having a body and mind constantly exposed to all of this contact, praise and blame, gain and loss, pain and pleasure, all of it. It is weary. But when the mind is cultivated and you have more mindfulness, you have more concentration, that which is becoming disenchanted, that which is becoming weary, is actually becoming more and more blissful. So that's an important part. And I like to give this teaching 2/3 into a retreat, because people by now have some experience of what it's like to have less passion, to be less fascinated, and you can actually feel that you are more contented. So if you want to define happiness as contentment, patience, well-being, clarity of mind, okay, that's a happiness that I encourage people to pursue. But in a way, the dispassion is what's forcing us to let go. We've been hanging on very tightly, and we've been fascinated with it. We've misperceived it. We've thought that it was a source of happiness and pleasure. We've had a closer look at it, and you're saying, oh my goodness, there's so much more pain than pleasure. it's really not worth it. You contemplate, you contemplate, you contemplate, and the more you contemplate that, you're experiencing your inner refuge, a more dependable tranquility, serenity, clarity. You begin to see that when you let go of this, begin to let go of this, there's less pain actually. You thought that it was going to give you pleasure, but when you start to let go of it, there's less pain. And so the dispassion and the weariness is what's allowing the mind to come inwards, because it's letting go of its fascination with outward things. It's able to reel itself in. When it reels itself in, it has more energy. The five spiritual powers, your faith deepens with a deeper understanding of this practice really works. And in reining the mind in, being less fascinated with sense objects and ideas of success and becoming, these kind of things, more and more of your mind's natural energy is present. It's not being dissipated out the six sense doors. And then you start to experience samadhi and tranquility and peace. And it's, so the disenchantment and the weariness orients the mind in a direction where it actually will finally fulfill its aspiration to be peaceful and happy, liberated. But it's not in a worldly way. It's not through praise or gain or pleasure or fame. It's through disenchantment and dispassion and putting things down. So as Zonpocha said, if you let go a little bit, you have a little bit of peace. If you let go a lot, you have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll be completely peaceful. And the path to be able to let go is what Ajahn Chah also says: when you want to meditate, you meditate. When you don't want to meditate, you meditate. When you're lazy, you meditate. When you're diligent, you meditate. When you're peaceful, you meditate. And when you're not peaceful, you meditate. So I offer this for your reflection.